Chot, which Rav Amital delivered on Rosh Hashanah, and in particular in Yom Kippur, were some of the most formative sichot. He delivered his ideas not just about Yom Narayim, but basic tenets, seminal, foundational issues about our relationship with Hashem, Am Yisrael, our commitment to Jewish history. He spent a lot of time preparing them. Unlike the tefillos, which he didn't seem to prepare. They had the feel of being much more spontaneous. He would spend a lot of time preparing these sichot, researching, finding midrashim. People of family told me that when he found the midrash, he was very excited about it. It was very midrashish. And obviously, one of the formative, if not the most formative event of his life was the Holocaust. And he didn't speak that often about the Holocaust, certainly in his earlier years. Toward the end of his life, we found him speaking a little bit more about the Holocaust. But during these sichot, he definitely streamed a lot of his memories of the Holocaust, and he certainly fused his Holocaust experiences with his sichot and his drashot for Yom Kippurim. And I wanted to share three memories, or three areas where the Holocaust, its impact, and its influence on Yom Narayim were felt very powerfully. Very often during the Ilah, Rav Amital would speak with us about, obviously, the honesty and the genuine nature of our tefillos, and how we have to, especially after the manner in which Yom Kippur can break down hubris and ego, human artifice, human presumption, we should daven in a much more innocent, almost helpless style. He would quote a Rivash, who himself quoted a Rabbeinu Shimon Mikinon, a French Rishon, who said that when a person davens, not of course l'nila, but in general, a person should daven like a tinok, like a baby, without kavanas amukos, without trying to think about what this word means and what it refers to, especially the Kabbalistic kavanot, which were very popular. Much simple, plain, unadorned, not really knowing what you want, but asking Hashem to even help you decide what you want and just provide the assistance that you don't even know what you're asking for. And he would try to get us into a place that was of greater emes, especially after the cumulative reductive effect of Yom Kippur towards the end during the Ilah. And he would quote the pasuk from Kuf Mem Hei, which we know as Ashrei, Karav Hashem l'chol karav, l'chol asher yikra'u v'emes. Hashem only answers people who call him honestly. And for Rav Amital, honesty was one of the, if not the fundamental trait of a relationship with Hashem, whose chosam is emes, and certainly in our tefillos, and our tefillos have to be emes, even if it means, according to the Gemara Megillah, that many Nevi'im deleted certain parts of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's, of the way we refer to him, because history just didn't reflect Hashem's gevuros or narot. Then they were later restored with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, but tefillah can't be, for Rav Amital, a very famous word, can't be mizuyaf, can't be forged, can't be fake. But despite all of his efforts to help us achieve a modality of emes, and therefore to have our tefillahs be accepted, Rav Amital would ask us in a very exasperated voice, in a crying voice, he'd do a lot of crying during the Ilah. He'd say, who can really be emes in our world? As much as we try, and as simple as we try to render our tefillos, and as boyish and childish as we try to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu without any pretense, we all are delusional at some level. We're all hypocritical at some level. We're not completely, completely honest with ourselves in our tefillos. And if we can't be honest, then how are our tefillos accepted if Hashem will only answer honest tefillos? And to help solve this, Rav Amital would then quote a different pasuk, not Karav Hashem l'chol karav, L'chol asher yikru v'emes, not Tehillim kuf mem he, but Tehillim nun aleph, lev nishbar v'nitke, Elokim lo tivzeh. Or, even more similar to the pasuk in Ashrei that says, Karav Hashem, l'chol karav, l'chol asher yikru v'emes, a pasuk in Tehillim lamedalet, Karav Hashem, l'nishbarei lev, ve'es dekei ruach yoshia. That even if a person isn't completely honest, and no human being living on this earth should have the pretense or the ego to believe the arrogance that they can be honest, when you approach Hashem brokenhearted, sad, needy, dependent, and you're shvui leif, and you're a dake ruach, then a Kodesh Baruch Hu is just as karov. There are two roots, the root of emes and the root of shivron leif, of being brokenhearted, being sad. And this is, of course, a moment for Avraham Mital to acknowledge the limitations of human experience, and I've spoken about this before, how that was such a central thrust in Rav Amital's developmental Torah. As much as we try to aspire to transcend our humanity, at some point we always come crashing to the ground. We always have to admit and accept our humanity and orient our Avodas Hashem and our religious identity through the limits of our human experience. And as much as we aspire for some voice of Karav Hashem l'chol karav l'chol hashayik uv emes, at some point humans must, if they're honest, acknowledge, and of course that's the irony, because if you're not honest, then you don't stand a chance to be involved in that first root of tefillah. But if you are honest, then you realize you're not honest, and then you are not a candidate for l'chol hashayik uv emes, but you are a candidate if you're shavur leiv. Karav Hashem l'nishbarei leiv v'ezdakei ruach yoshia. And Rav Amital would very often begin crying when he would quote that pasuk about being brokenhearted in the presence of Hashem, and hopefully each person, having spent 24 hours inspecting themselves, their behavior, their limitations, their flaws, would walk away brokenhearted. But then he would say, even if you're not yet brokenhearted by your own experience, he would talk about how after the Shoah, all of Am Yisrael is in the category of Nishbarei Leiv, of being brokenhearted. And you felt how powerful an impact the Shoah had on Rav Amital. And this is in some cases 40, 50, even 60 years after the Shoah. He still felt that Am Yisrael continued to suffer the trauma of the Holocaust. And in many ways, even if it wasn't true, even if maybe newer generations didn't feel the Holocaust so acutely, he was telling us that even if we didn't feel the shivron leiv, just our recognition and consciousness of the loss, even if it doesn't cause us to cry or to feel pain in our heart, rendered us shivrei leiv and rendered us candidates for Hashem's closeness and enthusiastic acceptance of our tefillos. So really, this sicha demonstrated both the impact of the Holocaust on Rav Amital's Yom Kippur sicha, but also in a very human way, allowing us to feel ratified that we were shvur leiv, even if we weren't crying or sensing the Holocaust as deeply as he sensed it, but just in our place in history and knowing what happened and living through that experience without the trauma and the immediacy that he lived with it, we were still classified as shvur leiv. He told us a lot about the tefillos during 1945 during Yom Narayan. Was the way the Rav Amital described it, in the area, the sector that he was a transitional period, where I think Rosh Hashanah time, they weren't in a concentration camp, but they were still being supervised or guarded by a German guard outside of the camp, on the road, or taking shelter in certain bombed out areas, cities and villages. By Yom Kippur time, things had gotten very murky. It wasn't clear who was in charge of the bombing, who was controlling the front, and they were hiding out in various cellars and davening. And as it got closer to Sukkot and Brastara, the tide shifted, and at that point, at one point, his German guard came over to his regiment, his group of Jewish prisoners, and says, "Until now, I've been guarding you, now you have to guard me." And we talk about the tefillos in those dark cellars, a couple Jews, probably no more than a minion, huddled together, very few machzorim, if any, people davening Baal Peh. And when they got to the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei, V'chein tein kavod Hashem li'amecha, tehila li'reecha, v'sikva tova li'dorshecha, u'fischon peh l'miyachalim lach, they were laughing at themselves. What does it mean that a Kadosh Baruch Hu should bestow honor on his people? Jewish blood was at this point cheaper than dog's blood. Jews were being mercilessly rounded up and slaughtered and executed. And they couldn't believe what they were saying. Of course, they continued davening. It's what a Jew does. But he would always compare and contrast that moment in 1945. And as dire as our situation in Eretz Yisrael seemed, there were some very low moments through the years. The Oslo Accord, or the after effects of the Oslo Accord, the terror, certainly the Second Intifada, the low points of the Lebanon War, and of course the aftermath of the yeshiva losing 8 of its Talmidim in the Yom Kippur War, you still had the sense that the kavod that Hashem was bestowing on Yisrael had been such a dramatic turnaround from the pathetic state that he had lived through, or the sad state of the Jewish peoplehood in that cellar in 1945. Perhaps his most potent Holocaust Yom Kippur message was when he talked about how severe the day is, how august as the Yom HaDin, and how much Yiras Hashem and Yiras HaOnesh underwrites the core of this day. He quoted a medrash in the Mechilta, Parsha Yudches, Masechta Dinizakin, about Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon being executed as part of the first wave of the Hasara Harugei Malchus. And Rabbi Shimon asked Rabbi Yishmael, I wish I knew why I was being killed. What's the reason for this punishment? Very interesting conversation on its own right. And Rabbi Shmuel slowly helps him realize that for a very, very slight and subtle offense, that when someone came to ask him a question at some point, a halacha question, and Rabbi Shimon may have been a little bit delayed in answering the question, and Rabbi Shmuel said, well, this is causing psychological suffering to the questionnaire by just not being as quick and as expeditious as you can, by maybe even drinking the person waiting for an answer. And Tzaddikim were judged that severely, that Rabbi Shimon would be executed as part of the Harugei Malchus for some, came and call it infraction, but minor inconvenience that most people wouldn't even be held accountable for, certainly not executed on behalf of. And yet Rabbi Shimon tells Rabbi Yishmael Nichamtani, now I can go to my death with peace of mind knowing that this is justified based on the type of life I led and the severity that Hashem judges me with. And Rav Amital felt that this shows how exacting Hashem's judgment and justice is. And it causes the type of response of Yiras Shamayim and the type of Yiras HaOnesh that typically characterizes Yom Kippur, that Nisan HaTokef crystallizes. He quoted a Yalkut Shimoni in Shir HaShirim, Shechorani Benava, in which the woman, in this case Am Yisrael, tells the onlookers, I'm both dark, but I'm also beautiful. Shechora, and in the articulation of Tanakh, Shechora is ugly. So what does it mean, you're ugly and you're pretty? Shechorani B'chol HaShana, the whole year, I'm a bit unattractive, but on Yom Kippur, I'm very attractive. And Rav Amital felt it because of the augmentation, the amplification of Yiras Shamayim. But having assumed that this is the baseline of classic or conventional Yom Kippur, Rav Amital said, how do people function with Yom Kippur, and how do they process Yom Kippur during the Holocaust? How could you build a Yom Kippur during the Holocaust based on Yiras HaShamayim and Yiras HaOnesh, based on the specter of Sifrei Chaim and Sifrei Mesim, Psuchim, Lefanav? That whole system of divine judgment and divine justice was seemingly completely irrelevant during the Holocaust. People weren't dying because of the fact that they were judged to death. They were just dying indiscriminately. They were dying below mishpat. He quoted a pasuk in Mishlei, Yesh nispeh below mishpat. People, again, we don't know Hashem's calculation, but we can only process through human lenses, and people were just dying in such large numbers. Children who never even begun to sin, mothers who were ripped away from their children. The whole notion of mi yechia mi yamos, they had all accepted their fate that they would die. They saw the death being random and indiscriminate. And how could anyone have experienced the Yom Kippur through the lenses or through the stream of mi yechia mi yamos? And Rav Amital said that in Europe during the Holocaust, Yom Kippur took a totally different flavor. It wasn't about the fear and the specter of Hashem judging human beings. It was more about Godless Hashem. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Ashrechem L'Yisrael, Mishnah Yoma, L'fnei mi'atem mitaharim u'mi mitahar eschem avichem sheva shamayim, shenemar mikve Yisrael Hashem. And of course, Rabbi Akiva is a perfect author for this because he lives through a trauma of his own during the Roman persecution that certainly isn't as severe as the Holocaust, but is a gloomy experience for and one in which you can well imagine that Sifra Chaim or Mason Petruchim wasn't the same compulsion that it is for us. And they felt the Romimus, the splendor, the majesty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yiskadav, Yiskadash, Shemei Rabba. And for Rav Amital, the Yom Kippur during Holocaust was able to highlight the dual nature of this day and allow us to realize that beyond the enormity of Hashem's judgment being rendered, it's a day of Hashem's godless. And I remember, and I'm speaking now, a personal story. I had a student quite a few years ago who had suffered a lot of unhealthy guilt in high school. He went to a high school that Rebbeim there made him feel very guilty about his malperformances and malfunctions religiously. And it had been very, very unhealthy for him in very, very severe ways. This wasn't a subtle issue of slight imbalance, but it caused real physical illness and real, I don't want to say too much, but it was not. It was a very, very unhealthy situation. And I worked with him the first month that he was in yeshiva to try to live with guilt or not feel so much guilt and to balance it out between a healthy degree of guilt, or at least in this case, not to overcorrect and to help him escape the heavy weight of guilt that he felt was hanging over his head. And I remember walking with him, Erev Yom Kippur, and the yeshiva was in full Yom Kippur mode and thinking about vidui and tshuva and guilt. And he said, Rebbe, how am I going to go through Yom Kippur? It feels like I'm going to return to that very dark space of guilt which had caused such suffering and mental anguish. So I felt that I had to be very fatherly to him and very absolute. I didn't want to give a measured or balanced answer. So I said, I don't want you to think about guilt at all. I don't want you to spend too much time on vidui this year and Yom Kippur fearing that plunging back into that unhealthy guilt would cause a regression, a very serious regression for a boy that had worked so hard. Then he asked me, well, what should I think about on Yom Kippur? And instinctively, I don't even think I had to remember the Sicha of Rav Amital. I don't think the Sefer had been put out yet. I said, just think about Godless Hashem. Think about what does it mean to have a Kodesh Baruch Hu who forgives people, who offers his people Yom Kippur, who forgives Am Yisrael every year. And Rav Amital used the Holocaust, in which clearly the specter of Yirah Shamayim wasn't as powerful to, not because they weren't Yirah Shamayim, but the whole notion of Miyachem Miyomos to highlight the other aspect. But in the classic balance, and that we still have to take the magnitude of Hashem's judgment seriously and not be, sometimes ideology makes us too careless and too rash and hasty, as if, well, we don't really care what Hashem says today. We only care about the larger issues of Hashem's malchus. He quoted a very beautiful medrash, Maran Gittin, actually, that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is negotiating the barter of Yavne for the city of Yerushalayim, a very controversial decision to save the future of Torah, even though he has to surrender Yerushalayim, he has a second request. He also wants some medicine for Bitzadok. Bitzadok had fasted 40 years to try to stave off the Chorban. He had been very ill. And it's almost a bizarre request. I want Yavne, and I also want a bottle of pills for a friend of mine named Rabbi Tzadok. It seems ridiculous alongside of the sublime, but this Gemara to Rav Amital highlighted that even when you're dealing with historically large and fateful issues, you still can't ignore the human element and that there's a person named Rabbi Tzadok who's suffering. And for Rav Amital, this was a metaphor that even when you're considering the godless Hashem, you can't completely overlook the fact that this is a day when human beings will receive judgments, and we hope that the judgments will be prosperous and favorable, but those are very much up in the air. So the Holocaust allowed Rav Amital to distill a Yom Kippur that had very little to do with Sifrei Chaim and Mason Psuchim, but not to let that other image of Yom Kippur overrun the image of Sifrei Chaim or Mason Psuchim. So these are three instances in which Rav Amital experienced or helped us experience our Yom Kippur and quoted the Holocaust as part of this Yom Kippur message. Number one, when he talked about the brokenheartedness that the Holocaust should cause in our generation and the way in which our broken hearts would facilitate a proper tefillah. Number two, remembering how futile they felt davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, asking him for kavod le'amecha, but now that kavod had been restored. And number three, realizing that in an environment in which Sifrei Chaim and Mason Pesuchim could not create the type of Yiras Shamayim and Yiras HaOnesh that it does for us, creating a different root for Yom Kippur, which he felt would complement the classic Nisan HaTokef Yom Kippur.